Thank you. You know, it's a pleasure to be here this morning and see so many friendly faces and familiar faces, and the your whole batting lineup. Everybody's much more distinguished and much more knowledgeable on this than myself. So I'm just going to start the ball rolling this morning with a little bit of kind of where we are, where we've been, where we can go conceivably as it pertains to policy and soil health. And Ted, thank you for inviting me to be part of this, because it wasn't until I was really working on this that I started to think big picture how to put various components of this soil health movement together in the context of what it may mean for policy. So with that, these are very personal views. Some are intended to instigate action. Some are intended to cause folks in the room to pause and think about what they've been doing. Some are intended to help us propel us forward in this. So take that as it may. But first off, why soil health? It is so dang simple. It's because we need to feed people. This is a context that, as we're riding this wave of popularity on soil health, and by the way, isn't it fun to be cool for a change? For all of us that have been working all these years on soil erosion and soil quality and soil health, suddenly we're the cool kids on the block, and it's the first time ever that we've ever been able to do that. But we got to remind ourselves, it's all about feeding people. I stole this quote. Everybody's using it. I attribute it to Glickman, but it's mostly just because I'm not going to lay claim to it myself. But the world's farmers, ranchers, and fishers are expected to produce more food in the next 40 years than they have in the last 8,000 years combined. So if we roll up the sheep that Abraham, Isaac, and Joseph were shepherds of to the production of the corn crop that we're harvesting today, we're going to have to produce more than that to feed this burgeoning population that we've got out there. This is a staggering thing, and it's so helpful to understand this, to understand the importance of what we're working on soil health. You see this all the time about we're going to 8.5, 9.5 billion people, but what is more important that we need to watch is that we are doubling the size of the middle class around the globe, and that means people demanding more meat, more milk, more products, and in turn, more challenges to our ecosystem. It is amazing to me the disparity that we have in the United States compared to where we are around the globe. In the U.S., only 6 to 7 cents out of every dollar goes to food. Globally, 1.4 billion people live on less than $1.25 a day. This is the charge that we have as we're working on soil health. Now, I was party to a conversation a few months ago, or just a month ago, and it was, should we talk about productivity as it pertains to soil health? Well, I think we have to. I think we have a moral obligation to, and the power of productivity is absolutely stunning when we look at where we've gone, where we've been, and where we are going today. 1940, about the time my father was graduating from high school and starting to come back to the farm, we were feeding 19 people, each of us as farmers. Today, each farmer feeds 155 people. Corn, we've gone from 24.5 bushels in the 30s to 160 plus today. These are the national averages. Grain sorghum, 16 bushels in 31, 62 today. Wheat, 14 in the 30s, 46 today. Cows, dairy. You can't do this on the national level, so I pull a Wisconsin thing. 5,000 pounds in 1933, 21,000 pounds today, and I hear rumors of these 38 and 40,000 pound super mama cows. This is the capacity that agriculture has to continue to produce. Now, if we were doing an audience like this and we were in Africa or if we were in Asia, people would be talking about sustainable intensification. And this is actually a concept that I think we need to take from the international development community and really embrace here in the United States and merge with our soil health movement, because it's really about producing more on the very best land and maximizing production while minimizing environmental impact. I contend with you that what we're working on today on soil health is going to be absolutely key to sustainable intensification. And here's why. 1940s, when my father came home from World War II, he was still putting up hay on our ranch with horses. So just in one generation, we've gone from horsepower to full-scale mechanization. That is our last generation aspects of technical advancement and sustainable intensification. Those advancements were genetic, tremendous gains in breeding, mechanical, tremendous gains in equipment, and in labor. We've reduced and eliminated the drudgery out of the North American model of American agriculture. Now we have to do the same thing around the globe. But next generation is all about farming by the inch rather than the acre. So we are now very good at maximizing these things. We're very good and we're making solid improvements on improving water use efficiency. Our modern tractors were twice as efficient today that we were in the 70s with our use per bushel of production. Nutrients, we're very good at precision placement of nutrients. Now we need to work at how do we keep it there so the plant can be able to utilize it. We're maximizing sunlight. This is a thing that I end up in D.C. trying to explain to folks all the time, how when we're talking about populations on corn and we're talking about precision planting, what we're really doing is trying to maximize our ability to capture the photosynthesis and to best harvest that sunlight. And that ties into the space in each of the work that we're doing there. So where is the remaining frontier for us? You know it. You live it if you're here today. It is about soil health. It's about what we're going to be able to do to take the same level of intensification that we've done on populations and breeding, that we've done on nutrient management and precision placement, that we've done on water use and efficiency, and actually put this in place around soil health. So what are the drivers that are out there for this sustainable intensification? It's marketplace. This is what we talked about first. It's demand for food, feed, fuel, fiber. It's this growing population and this very hungry world that we participate in. It is about productivity efficiency. And we're going to come back to that challenge with soil health at the end of my presentation. But this is an incredibly important component of where we're going. So what are the policy impacts of sustainable intensification? Obviously, farm programs. Do the farm programs stand in the way of intensification? Do they assist intensification? Where do they move forward? Trade policy. Believe it or not, things like Trade Promotion Authority, the TPP that is about to come before Congress, each of these things, fair and efficient trade is vitally important for both conservation and environmental issues. And that is because we need to maximize the productivity in those areas of the world that can, should, and be the best, most productive lands, and be able to move grain or livestock or fruits or vegetables to those who need it elsewhere. Rather than trying to do a misguided effort country by country on full sustainability and full being able to feed each of their populations, because that will double the environmental degradation associated with those activities. What's the research needs? This whole conference is about the research needs that are out there. And just as I mentioned, it's really cool, it's really fun to be in the soils right now. It is also ever more important to be able to really link the science back to soil health, and we're going to come to that. The other policy impact that we'll talk about today is crop insurance. Where does this most important of the farm policy tools best intersect with the conservation movement? And we got to start thinking about where it intersects with soil health and with conservation. So we know more about the movement of celestial bodies than about the soil underneath. Leonardo da Vinci, 1500s. Surprisingly enough, it could just as well be Wayne Honeycutt, 2015. It is still true today. And this is the challenge that we're facing. So what do we know? This is a slide I put together because we're not talking about this much as we pertain to soil health. But what do we know? We've got this wonderful baseline of knowledge that's based off of Sergo and the soil, all the soil classification work that we've invested in over the last 70 years of NRCS in this country. So what do we have? We have prime farmland. Class 1, 2, 3, I'm lumping it all together. It's a little too generous, but this is the land that can be responsibly farmed. 202 million acres today. Now, many meetings, you're going to stand around, folks are going to say, well, we're not going to find more farmland, so we're going to have to increase the productive capacity on that. Well, according to the Soil Survey, we got 202 million acres that we currently farm today that are prime farmland. We've got 8.7 million acres. This is according to the NRI from 2007. It's significantly less than this. I'm going to guess it's around 4 million acres today of prime land that's still in the CRP. There is over 37 million acres of prime land that we have in pasture land. And we have 20 million acres of prime farmland or prime land that are in rangeland. This is the baseline of land quality that we need to keep in mind as we're looking at on a soil health strategy, because there's only a few things we can and can't do. And what we're learning in soil health is that even some of the things that we were taught in college aren't necessarily true as we're testing the new boundaries on there. But we can't change the inherent land capability class. We're still working with that 202 million acres and that maybe additional 50 million acres that could be brought online if we need to. However, what we can do is we can optimize the potential. We can optimize the fertility, perhaps as important as fertility and potential, is we can optimize the water holding capacity. That's why no-till is so successful in my own farm operation in my area, South Dakota. My brother and I have a joke. Whenever we see somebody in conventional tillage in central South Dakota, we figure Grandpa's still alive. Because it's the only thing in our area of the world that keeps you out of no-till. But it's not the same everywhere in the country. And so we need to be able to optimize each of these things. And so what we've really learned on this journey that we've all been on soil conservation and on soil quality is that we can, in fact, improve soil health. Jerry Hatfield, God love him, I probably have learned more about soil health and soils issue from Jerry Hatfield than any man alive. And I am blatant about, I stole a line from Jerry Hatfield. And that is talking about the stocking rates. This isn't his words, but it's my words, the stocking rates that we have on our soils. Jerry told me, and this just lit me up, he said, in Iowa, Illinois, on corn ground, we have about 2 pachyderms per acre. 2 elephants an acre of flora and fauna beneath the soil that we have to feed. And how are we managing to feed those 2 elephants an acre? Now, I'm a rancher from South Dakota. I understand stocking rates. I understand how to maximize them. I understand what happens if I start to abuse my land and if I overgraze and if I have too many cows, I get in trouble. And when I started to think about, in the aspect of soil health, about having to feed 2 elephants an acre, and are we starving them in the fall and winter or are we nurturing them? Are we starving them in March, in April, before the corn and beans go in? or are we nurturing them? In that context, the strategies and the wisdoms of things like cover crops and the things like restoring organic matter, of manure, of even, if I can be radical enough, of biosolids back in there to recharge that nutrient cycle in as natural a way as we can has a tremendous attractiveness to me. And for that inner cowboy in me, it just makes sense. Just as I don't overgraze my land, I can't overstock or underfeed the flora and fauna associated with that land. So what do we need to better define soil health? There's going to be several of the folks that are going to talk about this, so I'm just starting to touch on it with you. But the thing that I see the most, economics of soil health. We need a lot of research on this. Tie the basic research that is here at this meeting with all the egghead work going on with the economists and bring this together so that we can really make the case for soil health. We also need systems approaches, localized, science-based approaches, and we need strong measurement. And several of the folks coming behind me are going to talk about their concepts on measurement. But the real key on this is make it repeatable, reliable, affordable. It's got to work as quickly, as efficiently, and cost-effectively as current soil testing. So in all likelihood, if we can just simply build off that foundation rather than trying to create new, we're going to be dollars ahead. And the most important thing, I think, is we need that better, that more complete science. So I mentioned it before. We need to be building on the foundation. And that's why I'm enjoying being here with you today, because you all represent that foundation. We cannot forget the basics. We've got to build upon the soil's foundation. We got to build policy looking at the fundamental need to improve productivity, sustainable intensification, if you will. If we're not improving productivity, if you're not improving profitability for the private landowner, we're only in an academic pursuit as it pertains to soil health. We've got to answer the sciences that are out there and the questions that are being asked about soil sequestration, about fertility, about water holding capacity. These three societies have been real leaders in taking American agriculture forward on climate change and not being afraid to really look at the tough questions about what does it mean. It makes sense to do the same thing in linking this leadership around climate change to the implications on soil's health as it pertains to resilience. We've got to answer these unresolved questions that are still being driven the debate out there about soil sequestration to be able to do that. The last thing is we can't use slick promotions and ads to achieve soil health. It's going to take robust economics and hard science. It's not just about a slick publication. It is really about the dollars and cents that the farmers who manage the millions of acres can look at and see and understand what the implications are going to be. So the policy of soil health, and I'll be able to wrap up very shortly on that. If the soil is destroyed, then our liberty of action and our choice is gone. This was Loudermilk in 1953. You know, folks talk about soil health. We've got great pioneers in soils that have really led the way on us that we can tap into. You got to look at what Hugh Hammond Bennett said, what Loudermilk said, what Kellogg said, to really appreciate where we've come from and where we're going in the future on that. So what policy really does support soil health? Now, I'm a recovering chief of NRCS, so I'm going to be very biased in talking mostly about NRCS programs and policies. But the key factor, what I call knowledge-based conservation, what everybody else calls conservation technology assistance, this is one of the most important key things that are going on that is out there. The soils data. We can't go very far on soil health without starting with the fundamentals. But yet, I see a certain separation between that portion of the movement and the soil health movement. And that's folly long term. We've got to bring these aspects of the discipline back together. We have the EQIP program, Environmental Quality Incentives Program, our traditional fix-it program in erosion efforts. We've got to look at where we go on that. We've got to put together a really state-of-the-edge set of enhancements around management, and that's what soil health really is, for the Conservation Stewardship Program. CRP, we've got to look at where we can do selected restorations of lands to be able to go there. And we've got to move this soil health effort from just NRCS and the research agencies down to the state conservation agencies and the conservation district efforts. We've got to link the whole infrastructure of conservation delivery back together as it pertains to soil health. So where are these policy gaps? What do we really need to be able to look at and tackle on? The first one is we're not always looking at this as a systems approach. And you've got to understand, systems approaches are inherently at conflict with our current practice and program-based conservation strategies. Now, we put things into programs and to practices because those tools have been successful for the last 75 or 80 years. There's real strong good reason for that. But we have to understand the limitations of those boxes when we have to start looking at a systems approach. The next area that I've been spending a lot of time trying to think about is this connectivity between conservation policy and crop insurance. And I tell you, quite honestly, it's been elusive for me and a lot of other folks that have been working on this. We are going to need to address this, though, if we're going to bring soil health into the next generation of conservation policy. Because with CSP on 50, 60, 70 million acres, with EQIP on 25 or 30 million acres a year, with CRP on about 24 million acres, you're not covering all the land base. But all the land base is covered with insurance. And so the real opportunity here is how can we do this and bring these things together, but do it appropriately. The other thing we need to do is we need to link risk management and productivity in conservation with the private sector. We simply can't do it alone using the traditional efforts of extension and NRCS and have a hope for being successful. So how can these policies better support soil health? First off, you know, Bianca, I love the fact that NRCS has created a soil health division. This is an outstanding step forward for the agency, but and here's the but on this. You know there's always a but with me. The but is that it needs to be embedded in everybody's duties and responsibilities, because if only one cadre of the team is responsible for soil health, the others are ignoring it. We need to focus on CSP. Improve the enhancements, manage for carbon, restore nutrient cycling. CSP has quietly become the largest program in the NRCS toolbox. And some segments of conservation have really gotten active about the enhancements. And I know CSP is up on blocks. It's being overhauled. It's being looked at. I know there's a robust set of enhancements coming. But the real potential of unleashing enhancements that can improve soil health, or at least enhancements that won't damage soil health, really needs to be examined on. We need to do the same thing with EQIP. I know our practice standards are very broad and they're very general, but we really need to look at how can they be improved with an eye on soil health so that 20 to 30 million acres a year of investment in EQIP enhances, emboldens, enables. There, it's going on. The other thing, and I think the speakers that follow me will reinforce this, we need to look at everything, not just cropland. We need to look at rangeland, pasture land, and forest land as we're looking at how do we improve soil health and providing the connectivity to those things. And we need to look at all practices and enhancements. We can't get caught in the trap that cover crops are sexy and all solutions lie with cover crops, or that all solutions lie with no-till, because this is a systems approach that needs to incorporate each of these efforts. So, with crop insurance and soil health, we aren't there yet. This is going to be very data intensive. And it is only today with current precision agriculture technologies that we have a ghost of a chance of bringing this together. We need to, however, start with the fundamentals and collect data on risk by soil type, by land classification, by organic matter, by management practice. And this means we've got to be able to do massive amounts of data mining from the last 20 or 30 years worth of research. Research that wasn't intended to calibrate this, but that can be used that way through meta-analysis to get us there. Then, once we've got that, we need to layer on by field rainfall and other aspects of weather data. We need to layer in the Farm Service Agency's CLUs, the common land units. We need to build a connectivity with modern agricultural data sources so that my yield monitors from the combine can layer that information in on top of that and move it correctly. Done correctly, we're going to be able to enhance the effectiveness of both crop insurance and soil health. And done correctly, you improve soil health on 200 million acres that are currently in production. So, the last thing we need to do, we got to commercialize soil health. We need to move it at the pace of commerce. This means that government policy and programs can serve as an accelerator, but it cannot be the only path. And soil health has to be proven to be profitable. So the big picture that we've got here, world population is going to continue to grow. We've got to feed people. We need to maximize the efficient use of the best land. That's going to be key. And no soil health solution will be successful that doesn't include private landowners as collaborators. So the final slide, engage the conservation movement. Make everyone's job, and you're going to see a slice of that this morning. Double down on the science. Engage, enable, and encourage the private sector. And most importantly, don't forget to feed the elephants. There you go, Ted. We're not taking questions, are we?
Yes, let's. Okay. Do we have any questions? We have time for one question. There, just go right ahead. Please repeat it.
Yeah, I'm curious about the messaging and what really gets distraction in terms of talking about soil health in the public. Because you talk a lot about our need to expand food production for increasing population. Last week I heard a speaker say we actually produce enough food for 13 billion people already through distribution and waste. We're just not getting it there. And I'm just wondering about, could we talk about soil health and or productivity in terms of, kilograms per gram of soil organic carbon or, these efficiency measures? You mentioned it early on, but I didn't see it later. And the idea that we have to actually intensify and increase production, I think, is somewhat counter to protecting and maintaining and promoting soil health. What are your thoughts on that?
Okay, so I've been asked to repeat the question. It's going to be a bit of a challenge because it's a little bit about the productivity challenge. Basically, I'm talking about needing to intensify, and that runs counter to most of the conservation efforts from the last 50 years. And it runs counter to what many of us as farmers have learned from experience. As a farmer, up until the last few years, I was always one bumper crop away from failure. Because when I had a big crop, everybody else had a big crop, and we had a surplus. Our farm policies of the 70s and 80s were all about reducing production and shorting the market. That's why the Conservation Reserve Program was born. Much of what we were taught in the 70s in environmental studies was about idling land and preserving land and holding it aside. It wasn't about working lands conservation. So we're in the midst of completely turning things upside down when we start looking at those things and we start thinking of our productive capacity not for the U.S., but for the globe, and understanding that hungry people will drive the conversion of fragile ecosystems somewhere in the globe if we don't respond to that with the very best land. So, with that, Ted's going to give me the hook. So, thank you.
Thank you very much.